Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Best Ever You Show with your host, Elizabeth Hamilton Guarino, CEO and founder of the Best Ever You Network, helping you live your life to the fullest. How? Real people, including celebrities, real advice, real places, products, and businesses, real life stories. It's all right here for you with this radio show, printed magazine, websites, community, and more. Remember to visit us online, too, at besteveryou.com. And now here's your host, CEO and founder of the Best Ever You Network, Elizabeth Hamilton Guarino.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Best Ever You Show. We're so happy that you're here with us. We always think there's a reason that you're here with us, and today we have a very special guest with us. We have Michelle Rosenthal with us, who is going to be joining me in just a minute here. I wanted to show you her website. If you're listening on the computer or you're listening on replay, you can click to her website while you're listening. It's yourlifeaftertrauma.com, and you spell her name M-I-C-H-E-L-E, not two L's there, R-O-S. E-N-T-H-A-L. And I'd also, before we get started, I'd just like to mention our sponsor today. This show for the entire hour is brought to you by Christine Demaray Brown Designs. So it's CDB Designs. And we have a new line of scarves and bracelets out there. You can go to bestelegance.com and check out that. We've got our autumn line up there, and we hope you will visit that. I've got one of the scarves on right now. Unfortunately, you can't see it because we're on the radio, but the scarf is, the scarf is $20, the bracelet's $25, or you can do this beautiful gift set that comes in a box with a bow, and it's a beautiful gift set for $35. So it makes a great stocking stuffer and just absolutely beautiful. And Christine is a childhood friend of mine all the way back from elementary school. We used to do science fair projects together, and we've sung talent shows together, and just a really, really good buddy of mine. We're not so good at math, but we figure we've been friends for about 35 years now. And so we're kind of collaborating between Best Ever You and CDB Designs. And I hope that you'll take a look at the website again. It's bestelegance.com. Really beautiful stuff, and she hand makes everything. It's just gorgeous. So, all right. So with that said, I want to welcome my guest. Hello, Michelle. How are you?
Hey, Elizabeth. I'm doing fantastic. Thank you so much for having me as your guest today.
Oh, I'm so excited for all that we're going to learn about you and all the things you're going to teach us about your life after trauma and what that exactly means over the next hour, because I have a feeling this show will really help, you know, this show and everything that you do, you know, not just this show, but everything that you do in your life helps so many people. And I just want to take a moment, if I could, and help me. Please feel free to interrupt me as I introduce you properly. But you're a keynote speaker. You're a post-trauma coach. I know you're an award-winning blogger. I love that about you. You're a poet and author. And you're also the host. I want to make sure I have this right. This is where I want you to interrupt me. You're the host of Your Life After Trauma, but I know you just switched stations. So which station is that on right now?
Yes, Your Life After Trauma is a weekly radio show, and we just moved onto Contact Talk Radio. We just, you have a sponsor, we have a new sponsor, and that's where they wanted to move us onto. And so I'm very excited to be on a platform like that. Contact Talk Radio is all about conscious living. And you can find more about it and how to listen to the show, which is Wednesdays at 2 o'clock on yourlifeaftertrauma.com.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I wanted to make sure I had the latest and greatest there, which I did, but I just wanted to make sure. You're also the founder of a website, Heal My, I'm guessing PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder.com, which is healmyptsd.com. I just watched a very interesting show about veterans. There's a judge who, when like veterans come back, they tend to get in trouble and can't make their way back into the world and, you know, function again, and they commit crimes and things like that. And instead of thinking they're criminals, he's realizing they're really suffering from PTSD. And so there's a whole have you heard this? There's a whole court system being put in place for our troops and things like that when they come back, so they can deal with the trauma. I wondered if you dealt with any of that. I thought that was so interesting and timely. I don't know if my radar was up a little because you're coming on the show. So I heard it.
It's your reticular activating system, hard at work, showing you where to focus. It's true. I'm very excited by things like that because I don't know if you you know, a little while ago, Dr. Phil did a whole show about veterans and just called, you know, veterans with PTSD or become monsters. And he made these outrageous and really stigmatizing comments about PTSD and our veterans in particular. And I think that it's very difficult as a veteran, and I work with clients both in my private practice, and I'm the director of wellness services for a veteran transition organization. And so we're implementing a whole coaching program that I've designed. And what I see so often, and this makes total sense, you're trained to live in a way where you are in danger all the time. And then you come back from Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever it is that you've served, and you're integrated into civilian life where all of that is useless to you, all of your training, that hypervigilance, that, you know, I'm going to defend at all costs. You don't function well in the civilian world living from that place. And it's a very difficult transition, and especially with post-traumatic stress disorder, all of those feelings are amplified. The danger is amplified, the threat, the fear, all of that is amplified. And unfortunately, that can cause a great amount of frustration and then lead people into acting out and behaving in ways that are, you know, not good. We'll just put it that way. There was a big report that came out in January from the Army of how increased domestic violence and child abuse is in veterans coming back.
Yeah.
And I think to a large extent that has a lot to do with having to transition from one mindset and state of being and another. And then, again, what you're bringing up is adding in the whole PTSD element where you're already, you know, for anyone who's ever had PTSD, you know, we don't think clearly. And we're always in a fog. And we are very quick to anger. So if you put all of that together with someone who's trained in combat, it can really be an explosive situation. And so I'm excited that there are things coming out that help recognize and raise awareness for that fact rather than stigmatize it.
Yeah. And, you know, what I wanted to ask you, I know that's one part of this whole thing, but could trauma be as simple as, and I don't mean to make something simple. Hang on, let me rephrase that because that's not what I meant. Could trauma be, trauma is different to everyone, I guess, is what I want to say.
You're so right. Yes.
That's
you're
the
making
point I
such
to
a
make.
Great point.
Because,
yes, I mean, yeah, go ahead.
Well, you know, something, it might be trivial to someone, but it might be a huge deal to somebody else. I'm just thinking of all the different ways, you know, people get divorced, people, you know, I've been resuscitated from food allergies, people, you know, there are so many different things that happen to people, and to some people it's a big deal, to some people it's not, and different things have different meanings to different people. So can you maybe, can we take maybe like one huge giant step back and maybe explain what happened to you and then also sort of what you mean by trauma? Like, why, you know, to get listeners, like, what, why would I listen to this show? I haven't been traumatized. You know, that kind of thinking.
Yes, and yeah, absolutely. And if you don't mind, I'd like to do it in the reverse order.
Perfect.
Just to ground us immediately in the answer to the question that you brought up and the point that you're making that's so important. Because trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder come from a lot of different sources, from natural disasters to food allergies, resuscitation, like you were discussing, to divorce, to anything. Originally, the whole concept of trauma and PTSD specifically was related to a life-threatening physical danger experience. But what we're noticing now as more and more research is done and as everybody rethinks everything and clinical perspectives shift and change, trauma really has so much to do with your perception of your experience. And so even the definition of post-traumatic stress disorder, the clinical approach to that is being expanded to include things beyond a physical life-threatening experience. So I think you're making a great point, and we can look at it in really, you started out, I think, in the right way to say simple. It is a very simple concept to say that there are differences between all of us, and my tolerance for fear is different than your tolerance for fear. So let's just say both of us were in a car accident, the very same car accident. We're in the car together. And we flip over, we roll over, whatever it is. We walk out. Luckily, we're okay.
Knocking on wood.
No. Yeah, knock on wood. But, you know, if this had happened yesterday, we're both okay. And we walk out, and you walk out, and you say, wow, isn't that lucky? We're totally fine. And you go buy a new car, and you get back on the highway. And I walk out, and I'm shaking for days, saying, oh, my God, I could have died. I could have died. I could have died. That's a very simple explanation for the difference in how we all approach trauma, because I experienced it in that situation very differently than you did.
Yeah.
So I think when we talk about trauma, it's really important to validate and to acknowledge that different types of traumas cause responses in people, partly due to the nature of the trauma itself and partly due to our response to it and our perception of who we are in that moment. You know, I'm somebody whose life is in danger versus I'm somebody who's so lucky that I'm fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
So does that answer the trauma question that you were posing?
Oh, I think perfectly. Absolutely. And just to, and there's so many different types of what you could call trauma. I mean, it could be, like you said, it could be anything. And just people deal with it in different ways. And it's really important to really respect that and not attach a stigma to it if somebody doesn't feel good.
And that's so true. And here's the thing that most, if you were to ask me, what's the most shocking and surprising thing you've learned from the work that you do, it would be this. And it came out of my own personal experience. So I'll just briefly then describe in answer to what you asked me earlier, what happened to me. I was a 13-year-old kid, completely idyllic childhood, wonderful family, having such a nice life, thinking the world was grand and fabulous. And I had a run-of-the-mill infection for which I was given a run-of-the-mill antibiotic, to which I had anything but a run-of-the-mill reaction to. And had the doctor, you know, taken the time to actually read my chart, he would have seen that there was an indication that I had a nearly fatal allergy to this medication. But for whatever reason, he didn't look at his chart, and we didn't know that. So he prescribed this medication that within the course of a week turned me into a full-body burn patient. So 100% of my skin completely lost by the time I actually emerged from the hospital. And when I came out of that, it was partly all the more frightening because what happened to me is so rare that none of the doctors in New York City, which is where I was, had ever seen what was happening to me. So I was surrounded by a bunch of people who didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, I had fantastic parents, and I came out of the hospital having lost 100% of my skin, knowing I would make a full physical recovery. And yes, I have scarring and some complications, but nothing that can't be lived with. So I know I'm going to be okay, and yet, Elizabeth, it just destroyed me as a little human being. That little 13-year-old girl, she just had no coping skills to understand what do you do with that kind of experience. And so it didn't take long before I fell off the abyss of post-traumatic stress disorder, and there are three major categories of symptoms, including avoidance, arousal, and re-experiencing. So avoidance, you know, you don't want it, you won't talk about it, you won't acknowledge that it happened, you can't go near anything that reminds you of it. Arousal, that state like we were talking about with the combat veterans, I'm always on alert, high anxiety, ready to defend myself, exaggerated startle response because I'm always on edge, and re-experiencing, that those intrusive thoughts that come up where you keep saying, don't think about that, don't think about that. And, you know, the more you try not to think about something, the more you think about it. And nightmares and flashbacks. So it didn't take long before I was really, you know, quite a little teenage mess. And at that time, PTSD was only being applied to veterans in the Vietnam War. So no one was looking at this little civilian kid as being anything related to trauma. I was just labeled a difficult teenager. And then because I'm a writer and an artist, it became, well, she's a temperamental artist, which is how I went through my 20s as a temperamental artist. And that, you know, that worked for me until I got to a point where I just thought, oh my God, I'm crazy. I'm really insane. And then I thought, well, some people in this world are crazy and I'm one of them. So that's my role here and I'll just deal, you know, I'll just live that way.
No,
and that's what you do because you don't know any better for
well,
a little while, right?
You know, it's interesting. You know, I really kind of the same thing. I had no idea what I was going to go through after I was resuscitated. And what you just said gave me goosebumps with the avoidance, arousal, and re-experiencing because I sometimes still have nightmares. And they it's not like when something happens to you, it just goes away. I'm sure as an adult right now, you remember fully what happened to you. It's just, do you want to consume yourself with it or not? And
I think that's a great point, and I think to be clear, you know, PTSD symptoms are PTSD is only diagnosed when the symptoms have been present for more than 4 weeks and are impeding in the person's ability to function in social, personal, and professional ways. So if you become completely dysfunctional, that's when the PTSD title is, or, you know, the diagnosis is given. But I think you're right, and I think you're making an accurate point that, and even today, I'm 100% recovered. I have zero PTSD symptoms, but I still remember what happened. And there is what we call an emotional weld that trauma creates. And until that emotional weld is severed, whether you have PTSD or just post-traumatic memories or responses or once in a while nightmares or whatever it is, until that emotional weld is severed, those things will continue because we do emotionally bond to our moments of terror. I mean, that's
sure.
What we do. That's how the mind learns. And so in recovery, we seek to, through a slew of different ways, we seek to eliminate that weld that trauma creates so that we do always remember it, but we no longer feel the emotional surge, whether that's in nightmares or thoughts or feelings. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And you know, there are so many ways to break that emotional weld, ways that are very gentle. And, you know, one of my biggest fears about recovery was I'm going to go crazy trying not to be crazy. You know, I just don't think I can handle the recovery process. And there were days that was true, and yet there also I found, you know, some modalities for treatment really trigger you and re-traumatize you, and others are very soft and gentle and help you move through in a way that allows you to sort of maintain some grounding. And when I moved into those processes, I did much better. And so it's really up to each of us to decide, you know, how do I feel most comfortable working, what modality and what person do I feel most comfortable working with?
Yeah.
So
if somebody
could get rid of those nightmares.
No, I completely agree. If somebody is listening right now and interrupt me right here again, and they're suffering from maybe these five things, whatever they are that maybe you could list, or 10 things, or whatever it is that indicates there's some type of post-traumatic stress disorder or trauma type, you know, behavior following some type of trauma. Who do they call and what do they do? That's kind of a lot of a question there. But,
that's,
you know, we're trying to help people here.
Yeah, that's a great and very loaded question.
Yeah.
So first, let me pull through the through line of what we were talking earlier. I had said to you, if you were to ask me the thing that most shocked and surprised me, it was based on how rare my traumatic illness was. It wasn't like, I mean, I have spoken to other survivors, but it's not like I've met a slew of people who survived my illness. So
exactly.
When I first started doing the work that I'm doing, I didn't plan actually to build the Heal My PTSD website or to launch the Your Life After Trauma radio show or even to write my PTSD and trauma recovery memoir. I never planned to do any of those things, and my book came out earlier this year, and I thought, oh my gosh, look, I did that. But I didn't plan to, because I just sat down years ago after my recovery and thought, I'm just going to blog about my PTSD experience. And I just am going to do it for me, because I've been a writer since I was 7, and nobody's going to understand what I'm talking about, but I'm just going to do it. And Elizabeth, the thing that shocked me more than anything was I immediately started receiving email from veterans saying, how do you know exactly how I feel? And then I started getting email from child abuse survivors, rape survivors, domestic violence survivors, car accident survivors saying, you just described exactly how I live each day.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to understand that while we're all completely individual in our traumatic experience, we are very universal in our post-traumatic experience. And that was interesting to me, because it allowed me to understand that we make a big community, and while we feel so isolated in trauma and so isolated in whatever level of post-traumatic stress we experience, we're really part of a group of people who understand us. And so it's important to find those people that you can connect with that will understand you in that space. Because then, and this answers the question you just asked me, your healing journey, uniquely your own. So
yeah.
Completely individual. It's like if you and I both had bronchitis and neither one of us were allergic to penicillin, we could both take penicillin and within 72 hours start to feel better, right?
Yeah.
There's a process we can all count on. PTSD is not like that. So if someone is experiencing any forms of avoidance, arousal, re-experiencing to the point that you are becoming completely dysfunctional and it's been more than 4 weeks, then I think that the first thing to do is to get a clinical assessment so that you know, do I have post-traumatic stress or do I have post-traumatic stress disorder? Because post-traumatic stress can be just your mind trying to figure out how to organize and integrate the experience. And that's not quite the same as a mind that's being totally sort of hijacked by all of these other symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing that is important is to know what you're dealing with, because then I think, and I'm sure you've experienced this, you're raising children, the more you know about something, the more you can be proactive in managing it, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know,
so,
yeah. Mm-hmm. When you tell your story, or elaborate about other people or anything like that, what is it important for people to say in response to you? I think so many people, when something happens to someone, as a fellow human being, it's, we're always, you know, I'm full of love, I'm full of compassion. But what do you say to people? Because is a role as somebody else in the room to be consoling? Is it to feel sorry for you? Is it to do you know what I'm trying to say? I'm trying to help people because there's a lot of people who suffer from trauma, and then there's a whole family that goes around them. And sometimes the family doesn't help the case, or sometimes your friend might say the wrong thing. Or what do you want to teach people to say to the person who's experiencing trauma or post-traumatic stress disorder?
That's a very sensitive question, Elizabeth. Sensitive on your part to ask it, not sensitive like it's tough to answer. I think it's a great place to focus. I think there are two things that happen simultaneously. I think number one, you have to do what's appropriate from a social perspective, and at the same time also tune into what seems appropriate from the survivor, the cues that you're receiving from the survivor. And I'll just use myself as an example, because and like even just you and I in this conversation, when I describe it to you and I kept going, mm-hmm. and I just sort of went right over your response, which was, oh my gosh, that sounds awful, or whatever it was that
yeah.
you said, right?
Because
I think go ahead.
Well, no, everybody is, and no matter who you are, I don't care who you are, there's always a level of discomfort when you're around another human being who has gone through something traumatic to them.
Exactly.
There's always,
yeah.
there's a bunch of different feelings that go on, from I feel bad for you, how can I help you, what would you like me to say to make you feel better, are you okay? I might be missing a bunch, but that's what goes through my mind when somebody even stubs their toe, you know.
because I've thought about this, because I originally could not talk about my trauma. And one of the reasons that I couldn't was I couldn't bear people's response to me. I couldn't bear the pity. I couldn't bear the horror that they were mirroring back to me. And so one of the reasons that I couldn't talk about it was I didn't want to have to deal with somebody else's response to it. So I have thought about this a lot, actually. So it's funny that you bring it up. I think that there are two things. I think we have to acknowledge and validate, yes, that occurred. So I think that's important to do, like what you did, like, oh, you know, like, yes, I'm acknowledging and I'm validating that was not nice. And then after that, I think we can take our cues from the survivor. With all the clients that I work with, I really wait for them to show me what they feel comfortable with. Some people really will start telling you all the details because they want you to connect with them in that space and share that pain. And other people will gloss right over it and sum it up in a sentence and they want to move on. And so I think you can sort of take your cue from the behavior of the survivor, how they want you to move with them through the information. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that definitely makes sense. The reason why I'm getting a little bit choppy here for a second is because there's actually, I think somebody's on hold to ask you a question, and I want to just check in with them to see if they're just listening to the show or if they wanted to ask you a question. So hang on just a minute, and I don't screen callers, so hold on.
Well, we'll wing it.
Yeah. Hi, caller from 305 area code. Did you want to ask a question, or are you just listening to the show?
I'm not sure. I've been through a lot of trauma and been a victim, and I'm still unable to climb out from that hole. And that's where I am. So it sounded interesting, and I decided to listen in.
Well, I'm so glad you're here with us. Michelle, did you want to answer her questions or comments? I'm just glad you're here with us. Yeah.
I think welcome, and I am so glad that you're here, because I think one of the hardest things to do is figure out, how do I get out of here? You know, my trauma occurred in 1981, and then it was 24 years before I was finally diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. So it was a long time of not knowing what was wrong and then being diagnosed and having that same question that you're having, which is, I just don't know, how do I get out of here? And so to that point, I would say the first most important thing is education around what it is that you're struggling with and what the options are to relieve yourself. There are terrific treatments for trauma. Let's just put PTSD aside, because whether you have PTSD or not is irrelevant to what I'm saying. Both respond to treatments. And treatment can range everything from what we all know as traditional, like talk therapy, cognitive behavior therapy, dialectical behavior therapy. And what I really love and responded to is taking it outside of the traditional box. There are tons of ways to heal from trauma that are alternative, including hypnosis, neurolinguistic programming, somatic experiencing, any of the energy processing therapies that maybe you've heard of, tapping, which is emotional freedom technique, and thought field therapy. And so you have a lot of options for moving forward. Education becomes the key, because it's really up to you, and the HealMyPTSD.com website has information on all of what I'm talking about right now. There's a treatment tab, so if you go on there, it'll just give you information about all of these different processes. It's really taking a look at what's available to you and saying, okay, that one sounds like I'd be comfortable. And then from there, finding someone who can facilitate that for you. It's always possible to heal. You just have to find your path.
Thank you, Michelle, and thank you, Elizabeth, for the program. I'll just continue listening. I've had so many traumas that I'm going to definitely have to educate myself and see how I can come out of this one. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening.
You're welcome.
I hope this show changes your life. I really do. I wish you the very best. We're going to keep on going. I'm going to mute your phone back out. But if you do have another question, maybe I'll check back at the end of the show. We've got about 30 minutes left. But you know, this is real, isn't it, Michelle? It's really real for people. And I applaud her for being so brave to call in and listen to this show. It's a huge first step, isn't it?
It is. I always tell people that reach out to me, because I get a lot of email from survivors, the very most important first step is reaching out, whether it's listening to a radio show, reading a book, listening to a podcast, looking at a blog. The first thing and the most important thing in recovery is being willing to take responsibility for being the person that has to move yourself into that space. And I know that's not easy, and I know I refused to do that for a really long time.
Well, I want to ask about that for a second, because go back. I don't want to take you back into trauma moment, but I'm go back to when you were 13, if you can, for a second.
Yeah.
And how would your life have been different if these signs and symptoms and everything were recognized and treated when you were 13? What was it even possible that somebody could have helped you when you were 13? Does that make sense? I don't know if I'm asking that perfectly, but
I think that makes sense.
We're more in tune to that this now than we've ever been. So if a child is suffering from something like this, we're on it. It seems like everybody's on it, whereas it doesn't seem like it was like that a lot. I think a lot of people for a long time have suffered in silence.
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder and trauma goes back to the beginning of time. So you're absolutely right. And I think I'm hearing you really make two points here. Number one, in 1981, there really wasn't the research or the awareness or the people who were trained to help me. You know, regular psychiatrists and psychologists do not know much about trauma. You really need to work with someone who's trained in trauma, and, you know, all the more benefit if they're really trained in PTSD, and all the more benefit if they've actually overcome it, because then you're working with someone who knows what it feels like from the inside out, and so there are enormous benefits there. So I don't think it was possible for me to be helped to the degree that I needed help in 1981 or in any of the 80s or, frankly, the 90s, because, you know, in the past 10 years, the surge of information has just been so amazing, and the research and people who have stepped up in the past 10 years in a way to really lead where the research goes and how we apply it. That having been said, I think that had I had the right intervention in 1981, I'd be a very different person today. Now, is that good or bad? I don't know, because maybe my life path was, this is exactly the way it's supposed to go. But, you know, as a child who goes through a trauma, you create your identity of who you are most significantly between the ages of 13 and 18. And so if there's anything that gets in the way of that process, whether you've had a trauma at 2, 10, or 14, or 13, as I did, you're coming at that whole identity process already skewed and somewhat distorted, because you've already developed belief systems that are going to feed into your identity. For example, I came out of my trauma, and because of things that had happened during my trauma, I had the deep belief that I did not deserve to survive, that I should have died. And that became a driving force in who I was at that time. So my whole identity became, you know, designed around that idea. And I think that you come out of your identity forming years depending on what your beliefs are at that time. And so I think I probably would have been a different person had that not been my entire driving belief system.
What was the artwork
during
like
those really formative years?
What was the artwork like during that period of time, Michelle?
Unfortunately, I'm not a visual artist. I'm a writer, so it was a lot of poems about being pulled under. And you know what? You're so right, Elizabeth, because all the poems were about the dark blackness of being pulled underneath the ocean.
I still
have my notebooks from that time.
Well, I bet it. I bet they're amazing. Sometimes, you know, that's where art comes from, is the pain. But, you know, bravo to you for turning everything in, you know, around. I'm sure it's just been incredibly, incredibly difficult. It's a really long time, 25 years. And I'm wondering if you would tell us maybe some of the symptoms. Like, what are some of the symptoms that you went through or or what people go through? How do you actually know you've got this? What, you know, like a food allergy, you know, you can not breathe or have hives. That seems sometimes kind of obvious. What is this? What makes this obvious that this is what you're suffering from?
Well, let me say before I answer that it is never obvious. So PTSD can look like a lot of different things. So in order to know that you really have it, it is really important to do two things. One place that you can start is with a self-test. The Heal My PTSD website has a PTSD self-test available. It's completely free. It's based on the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is our clinical diagnostic Bible. And there are 22 questions, and if you find yourself answering positively to most of them, you probably have PTSD. But you will only know that you have it for sure if you have a clinical assessment, because, and this happens a lot, bipolar disorder can look like PTSD, borderline personality disorder can look like PTSD, so you have to be really clear on what it is that you're struggling with and not self-diagnose. Let me clarify that. I think self-diagnosis is great if it gets you on track, but I think if you're inaccurate in your self-diagnosis, it can take you down the wrong road. So I think it's always good to have professional input.
You know, we just laughed. We just laughed on a show about trauma. How important is laughter, and how important, you have a sense of humor. Where did that come from in all of this, and how important is that to you?
I think it's critical. I really do. Let's just talk about the science of the brain. When you laugh, your brain produces oxytocin. Oxytocin helps you learn. It's a mood elevator. It's a fantastic thing to have running around your brain. So from a scientific standpoint in recovery, laughter is fantastic. Also, you know, we bring to us what we're thinking about. So if you're struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, mostly what you're thinking about is, I'm in danger, I'm powerless, I'm helpless, I'm always going to be like this, I have no future. We're putting all of those thoughts front and center, and it's very difficult to heal through that fog. So in my own recovery, I got to a day where things were so bad. I was so depressed, so stuck, so triggered. I was having nightmares all the time, and things were just bad. And I got to a day, and I write about this, my recovery memoir is called Before the World Intruded, and it's all about my quest to sort of figure out who I was supposed to be before the world intruded. I kept trying to go back to who I was before the world intruded, and of course you can't do that. So then I had to figure out, well, who do I become now? And in the arc of that discovery, I got to a day, and I write about it in the book. It was this big epiphany for me. I decided I need to feel the opposite of how I feel every day, at least once a day, and at least just for 60 seconds. I just need to feel something else. And I decided that what I wanted to feel was joy. And you mentioned that I have a sense of humor. My family had a sense of humor, and I spent a lot of time not able to laugh at anything, but wanting to. So sometimes we can't do the thing we want, but we can build the hope for it and the desire for it. And so I decided to go after this experience of joy, which I felt would reconnect me to a place of laughter and a place of fun and a place of happiness in a body and in a mind which I felt were dead. So I didn't have a lot of evidence that I'd be able to do this, but I decided I was going to try. And how do you connect to that joyful place when you're feeling so horrible? And I looked over my life and said, what's one activity that when I do it, I just get lost in a great feeling? And for me, that's dance. And you know, I'm from New York City, so that's like, you know, club dancing. And I've always loved to do that. But now I live in a beach town and you can't go club dancing on a Monday night. So I decided, well, I'll sign up for a dance class every day of the week. And I have no idea how to partner dance, and I have no idea how to cha-cha or salsa or hustle or any of these things. But I'm going to go no matter how horrible I feel, just because I want to try to create for myself this new experience, this new feeling, a way to access another part of myself a part that is healthy and untraumatized. And to be honest with you, Elizabeth, I didn't know if it would work. I just wanted it to work. So based on my desire, I went for it. And the amazing thing that happened was that I did facilitate a reconnection with that place of feeling good. And it didn't last all day, every day, but day after day, I went after it, class after class, developing that connection until it got stronger and stronger and stronger, and it tipped the balance in my recovery. And it was an amazing experience. And I see this now with the clients that I work with. I'll say to them, tell me an activity that you just get lost in when you do it. I have one client, she loves to ride Harley motorcycles. Another client, he just took himself to the Florida Keys. He wanted to get on a wave runner and just spend a couple hours that way. What happens is that we then create new neural pathways, activate old ones that have been just not active for so long, and we start teaching and retraining our brain and our minds and activating muscle memory that starts to help shift us into a more strong, more empowered, more hopeful place, which is the opposite of where we are after trauma. And in allowing yourself to connect to that place, you start giving yourself real strength for recovery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do. I think that's so important in all of our lives because it could, like I said before, and like you said before, it could be the smallest of things bothering you on a daily basis. And that might be creating a huge pool of, I'll use pool, not a cesspool, uh-huh. but a pool of just negativity or trauma or whatever it is. And it's so important to find that joy. I so agree. Becoming a joyologist is a really key thing in life. And to find those things, sometimes it's even going back to the things you enjoyed as a child. It could be bike riding. It could be roller skating. It could be swimming. It could be, there's so many things, and just reconnecting. That also helps you so you don't age.
Totally true.
Well, everybody's going to age,
right.
But you know, age more elegantly and gracefully.
Yeah, and gracefully and happily and happily. And I think it's also important to understand. And I didn't realize this until the end of my recovery, but it was so exciting and something that I think I had vaguely hoped for and had an idea of, but couldn't prove until the end when I realized that trauma distorts and changes us for sure. But there is underneath all of that a genuine, authentic self that always remains trauma-free. There is that part of you that is hardwired for joy and happiness and laughter and all the good things. And that part is still alive and remains. And the way that I like to describe it is it's like you're walking along one day and all of a sudden out of nowhere an enormous pile of garbage dumps on you and you are just smothered in it. Well, inside all that garbage, you still have lungs, kidneys, a liver, a stomach, you know. You are still the same person you were before the garbage fell on you, but now you're just covered in all this yuck. And trauma recovery is really climbing out of all of that and then cleaning yourself back up to discover that, gosh, even though all that was so gross and disgusting, I still have the same kidneys I had, the same stomach, the same lungs, my heart's still beating. And I think we don't talk about that enough, but it is true and it's real. And I see it in the survivors that I talk to who are healing. They all are coming back to a place of that genuine, authentic self. And when you allow yourself to be guided by that quest, I think there are amazing things that can come out of recovery, not just recovering, but going on to live a life that's full of meaning and purpose and joy and laughter.
Do you think, let me see if I phrase this one right, the questions with you are a little complicated, so I need to...
I think you're doing a great job. They may seem complicated in your head, but they come out really fine.
They're a little bit, but what I'm trying to ask is, do you know how sometimes people feel like there's a dark cloud that just looms over them, and it's not going away, just thing after thing after thing after thing after thing. It could be five traumatizing things instead of just one, or it could be just minor little thing, you know, nothing ever good happens to me kind of thinking. Cloud, you know, not cloud over anybody else, cloud over me kind of thing. What do you say to that?
What do I say to the cloud?
To the person, to the cloud, is it real? Is it imaginary? Is it perceived? Is it true? How do you get out of it? You know, all of that stuff to the person who feels like the cloud just isn't going to blow over. The storm's not going away. It just is what it is.
I was working with a client this morning who we were talking just about that and the idea that, you know, when is this going to be over? When am I going to be done with my recovery? Why am I not finished? And she's only been working at it for about 4 months, so that's not long in recovery speak. And I remember even myself, you know, sitting in my therapist's office crying and crying week after week, we're never going to be finished. I'm going to be 90 and still talking to you. And what, you know, when is it going to end? And I think that the most important thing to know is that the cloud... Clouds, I mean, technically, what are clouds? They're just water, really. It's vapor. So the cloud itself is mutable. It can be removed. And it does change and morph and evaporate as you go through recovery. I think it's less important to look at the cloud and more important to look at where you are and what you're doing. Are you working at this? Are you working with the right person? Are you working with the right modality? Are you working every day? Because a lot of times what happens is, and I was so guilty of this, I would go to therapy and then the rest of the week just give myself like time off as if all of recovery happens in my therapist's office in those 50 minutes. And that's not the case. If you're not working your recovery every day, then you're not going to see the cloud, you know, evaporate as quickly as you want it to.
Yeah.
And when I say working recovery, that means coming at every day with the right attitude, doing the hard work. I run PTSD support groups, and we had a great meeting last night. One of the women in there went through a very hard week, really addressing a very difficult part of the recovery process. And bringing herself out of it was not easy, but she stuck with it every day of the week. And you do little things. I think one of the hardest things about any task, I mean, if you just think about, you know, like climbing Mount Everest, you're at the bottom looking at the top of the mountain with this huge pack on your back thinking, how am I going to do this? And we do that with recovery. We look at the whole recovery and think, oh my God, when is this ever going to end? How am I going to do this? But do you ski, Elizabeth?
I'm the world's worst skier ever.
Okay, you and me both. When my brother taught me how to ski, my baby brother, so I was in my 20s, and he and his college friends.
Yeah,
he and my college friends decided they were going to take me up to New Hampshire and teach me to ski. And this is what they did. And this is why you should never let three college guys teach you to ski. They took me to the top of a mountain, taught me how to fall down, and told me, they'll meet me at the bottom.
Trauma.
And I looked at them and said, I have no skill. I have no technique. How am I going to do this? Look how far it is. And they said to me, well, don't look at how far it is. Just look at the next 10 feet. And there's a great metaphor there for trauma recovery. Because if we look at when is it going to be over, we're constantly focused in the future. But recovery happens in the present. So it's really a matter of looking at where I am today, what am I doing? And the cloud is going to be there as long as the cloud is there. It's irrelevant.
Yeah, you know,
what's really important is what
is
I'm
huge.
Doing.
Yeah, well, that is so huge, is to stay. You can't control the future. You can't force the future, and you definitely can't change your past. You're right here, right now, and that's so important. And the other thing I always think to be reminded of, and I don't know whether this really helps survivors or not, but, you know, we're not really entitled to another moment. No one's entitled. And so teaching people to find joy in the moment, I don't know if that's possible with trauma survivors, but finding that positive right here, right now, and some joy in your life daily, like you're suggesting, is probably so important. I was thinking, as we were talking about clouds, the whole thing, time you were talking about clouds, every time the word cloud came up, I'm like, what would happen if on a daily basis to somebody who feels like they have a cloud looming, they just painted the cloud yellow or pink or blue or painted purple, painted a different color? I wonder what would happen.
I think that's a great suggestion because, you know, our minds represent the world to us in three dominant processes: visual pictures that your mind makes, and you're talking about changing that picture, auditory things like your voice in your head, and kinesthetic, how you feel in your body. And so whenever you change any of those sources, you change your experience of the moment. So that's brilliant what you just said, because then if you've got this black cloud over you, well, change it to blue or pink or yellow or, you know, neon green. Yeah. Because when you do that, it is going to shift how you feel about the cloud, because I'm doing it in my head while we're talking about it.
Uh-huh.
And when you think about a black cloud, it's like it's low.
Ooh.
It's sitting
yeah.
on you.
Mine's yellow.
But if you change it, and mine's green. So if you change it to a different color, suddenly it's lighter. It moves away a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's a totally different feeling.
That's what I was thinking the whole time we were talking. The other thing that I was thinking of for some reason while we were talking here was about animals. And, like, I love turtles. And anytime I'm having anything go on with that just isn't outstanding, you know, I don't know why, but I love cats, dogs, and turtles. And I have this yellow. It's interesting. It's yellow. Everything in my life that I do that with is yellow. But I have this yellow turtle. It's made of, like, a beeswax. This is a yellow turtle candle, and I love it. And it just makes something, you know, do we ever do that with objects? Like I know this is a common labor thing, like when you're in pain, focus on this happy object, and maybe the pain will go away a little bit. Do people ever do that as a way to meditate or a way to rethink something or anything like that, focus on something that really makes you happy?
Yeah, definitely. And it's funny you should bring this up because really you're talking, or you're not talking about, but you're underscoring a point of being present. And my whole radio show tomorrow is all about how to become more present because it's so important in trauma recovery. And I think really what you're pointing out is that we can identify things that help ground and center us to the present moment. You know, in my recovery, I carried around pictures that I had of myself smiling because I didn't ever feel happy. So I carried around pictures of myself that in which I could see, oh, look, in that moment I was happy. So when I felt really badly about myself, I would look at those pictures and say, look, there's got to be a way to get to that. There's got to be a way to access that girl. And for other people, it can be that you carry a stone that you have written a meaningful word on, and you just carry it in your pocket and touch it, pull it out, play with it throughout the day. Or like you were talking about, play with the pictures in your mind. It can even be a scent or a sound that really just grounds you in a good feeling. And, you know, when we talk about healing trauma, it's always important also to understand that in that process, while we're severing that emotional weld, we're also retraining the brain to a new way of thinking and looking at things and being and living. And the more ways that you do that while you're going through the trauma recovery process, the more you support your recovery process. And that's part of what I mean by, are you working every day? Are you trying to access something in the smallest way? Chunking everything down, you know, like what I said earlier, I wanted to feel joy and I just wanted it for 60 seconds. If I could just access it for 60 seconds, I'd be happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
And it started out that was my goal. And then, of course, I was able to increase and increase and increase it until I'm a phenomenal dancer now. You know, I went to so many dance classes, but now I'm really good.
Yep.
So, you know, out of that little quest to feel joy came a whole lifestyle for me. I teach, I perform, I have a fantastic dance partner, and it is still a part of my life because once you start accessing joy, who would ever want to give that up?
Yeah.
And so it's a part of my life even now, and it has zero to do with my recovery and everything to do with creating a joyful, meaningful, and purposeful life in the present moment now that my recovery is done.
Yeah, eventually the joy will take over.
If you
let it. But I wanted to just mention too, we didn't even really talk about your book very much, but you're the author of But that sounded very East Coast out of my Midwest self. You're the author of Before the World Intruded. I've lived in Maine for 8 years now. Before the World Intruded, Conquering the Past and Creating the Future. What is the book about? Where can people find the book, buy the book, and so forth? Just give us a little bit of information there.
Yeah, you can find it on Amazon. You can also find it on my website, yourlifeaftertrauma.com. The book is all about, literally, it is the arc of my trauma, PTSD, and recovery process. So it starts with trauma, and, you know, it's a raw look at what that turned me into. So it's not necessarily a pretty picture, but you go from there all the way through. The last third of my book is this magical recovery process that I ended up defining for myself. And it has this wonderful, happy Hollywood ending that I never would have expected. So the book takes you on that arc from this girl, this young girl who is completely traumatized, through this young woman who is completely, you know, just stuck and failing miserably at everything in life. And then moving into the recovery process that did not go well for me at first. It was a bumpy road. And then I sort of moved into a place where I stepped up my responsibility. I decided to take control of the process. And I started to follow my intuition and educate myself. And the more I put myself into the recovery process, the more I got out of it. So the end of the book is this wonderful transformation that just lets you know if you are, you know, thinking, well, I've been this way for 5 years, so I'm probably going to stay this way. That is absolutely not true. Total falsity. So you cannot use that excuse to not do the work of trauma. Recent advances in neuroplasticity show us that the brain is hardwired to heal, which means that it's a totally opposite philosophy from what we used to believe, which is that by the time you were, you know, a teenager, your brain was completely formed. That was all the neural pathways you were going to have. We now know that the brain creates neural pathways up until the very last day that you have on this earth, which means your brain has inherently in its DNA the capacity to heal, which means it's never too soon, it's never too late to start your process to move forward. If I could heal after 25 years of being a complete wreck, just about anybody could. But you have to want to get better. That is my one caveat.
Yeah, you definitely
have
to
want to
get
better, you will
better.
Find the way.
Yeah. Yeah, when you want something, you will find a way. That is definitely for sure. Now, we have got about 2.5 minutes left to speak with you. I can't believe that was a whole hour. Is there anything I missed?
Missed. So if you would let me share, one of the things that when my book came out earlier this year, one of the things that I did was launch Project Give Back. One of my goals is to build community, and that's communities of survivors and communities of professionals and a community of both. And I went to all of my contacts and I said, look, I have this book coming out. What I really want to do is give back to everybody who is on the recovery path. And I ask all of these trauma specialists to please donate something that would help someone in recovery, whether it's a video series or an audio MP3 or a PDF file or a book. And I had such a great response. We launched Project Give Back, which offers every single person who purchases the book almost $2,000 worth of free trauma support and recovery material.
Wow.
So it's amazing. And you can find out more about that on yourlifeaftertrauma.com. Just click on the Project Give Back link, and it will show you, there's a page that shows you all of the different things that people have contributed, from MP3s to help you sleep to, there is a great video series on how to deal with anxiety. And it's been so rewarding to me to be able, and I know like you too, Elizabeth, you want to do something good in the world. And I think that when we really get creative, we can create opportunities for all of us to come together and do something good together. And so I'm so pleased that
really
was
neat.
One of the outcomes of my story, you know, was to bring us to a place where we could help other people.
Great. Yeah, that's so important. So let me hang on 1 second. We're going to run out of time here. I just want to push people back to your website, which is yourlifeaftertrauma.com. And please, if you find this show helped you and you think it could help someone else, please forward it and contact Michelle. And I just want to thank you so much, Michelle, for being with us for the full hour. And I want to thank the caller, really, for stepping up to the plate there and calling us and being on the radio with us and really sharing your experience with us as well. So thank you, Michelle. I can't wait to have
you on. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you. All right. We're short on time. I got to go. Lots of love.
Thanks for listening to the Best Ever You Show. Want more? Visit us at besteveryou.com. Be your best and keep it real. Confident, successful, caring, and beautiful every day with Best Ever You.